Marilyn, why don't you come on up? We've got your bill up first. As soon as we have a quorum, we've got a number of bills set for work session, but folks are moving a little slowly this morning. Good morning. How are you?
I'm awake, Madam Chair.
That's a miracle given this early in the morning. Take it away, Richard. Senator Devlin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, I am here to support SB 1071. For the record, I am Senator Richard Devlin, Senate District 19. The purpose of SB 1071 is to establish a virtual school district that will provide uniform access and quality instruction for all K-12 students. It will also allow the State Board of Education and the Superintendent of Public Instruction to more clearly address the challenges that have arisen when a school district has attempted to claim the ADMW for potential online students. The bill before you today will have a number of parties that will come up after me speaking in support. Ms. Fleming from the Superintendent's Office, there should be someone here from the Oregon Education Association, the Oregon School Boards Association, and the Confederation of Oregon School District Administrators. Distance learning is something that that many people probably in the building think of very positively, but do not probably have a clear idea of what the meaning of it is or what the potential of it is. About a year ago, I attended a conference in which I saw some of the aspects of distance learning and what had been done around the nation, and I realized that although Oregon is going in many directions in distance learning and it's doing quite well in many areas, the potential is clearly there to do a lot more, and there are many states that have actually done a lot more. But where are we now as a state? For Oregon K-12, there are currently 365 public credit-bearing course offerings through online video conference modalities. They are provided by 7 ESDs, 3 school districts, and 2 university K-12 programs. Students may use these programs to access content not available to them in their home districts or because of scheduling conflicts, to recover credit, do credit options, accelerated learning options, to attend public school while infirm or incarcerated. These are just a few of the examples of where distance learning is a positive aspect to Oregon's educational system. But what are the barriers? The system is currently available through a handful of disparate locations, prohibiting uniform access to all students. Secondarily, there are no uniform accountability standards and guidelines for course development or delivery, prohibiting any type of clear quality control. SB 1071 would provide a framework for a uniform, standards-based virtual program available to all students in need of supplemental or alternative instruction options. The framework would include a fee structure that results in a self-supporting delivery system. Also, the framework supports a seamless system with common course numbering, common and uniform data. The shared technology system statewide, the outcome would be a portal that provides uniform and equal access to all Oregon students. Vertical and horizontal connection access for all students to any public educational opportunity, something that is clearly possible not 10 years from now, not 20 years from now, but possible within this biennium. In summary, a virtual school district offers an alternative learning environment that can accommodate the diverse needs of Oregon students, ensures quality program and clear-cut accountability measures. I urge your support today for Senate Bill 1071 and ask that you refer it to the Senate Special Budget Committee with the due pass recommendation.
Good morning, Charlie. Thank you, Senator Devlin. A couple questions for you. Would this be available to K-12 students on a statewide basis?
Yes, it would.
Okay. And I noticed that the bill has an emergency clause in it. When do you anticipate the system could be actually up and running?
I would believe that the Department of Education could have the system up and running, and Ms. Fleming is here, and she may want to correct me, within 8 to 12 months after the start of the biennium.
And
presuming that we could approve, that we have an approved budget at the beginning of the biennium.
Any requirement that parents be at home while students are virtually attending school?
No, Madam Chair, but I will tell you quite honestly, it's like one of those things that I know that I'm a little bit older than the chairperson, but it's like one of those things about how we think about PCs and how about young people think about PCs. If you go to any college student today at Willamette or anywhere else, they will probably have taken a number of online courses. It is becoming far more normal today to take courses online when you can't fit them into your schedule or when particularly that section isn't offered by a public university or a private university. Distance learning is becoming far more the norm in many areas. But I think actually still there will be a responsibility for parents in a distance learning environment, just like there's a responsibility for parents in a classroom environment.
Okay, good response. And then I assume the credits from the virtual program are treated like any other classroom credits?
That would be correct. That's the idea of providing some uniform standards.
Okay. Any other questions for Senator Evelyn? Senator Shields.
Yes, Senator, Salem-Keizer School District has what's called SK Online, which is an online school. A student has to pay for a class to take it online unless they're in a special school that somehow it's already covered. I don't know if other school districts in the area can access SK Online or not. Can that happen? Will students have to pay a fee like they do to Salem-Keizer to take a class?
Well, I think, Madam Chair, Senator Shields, I think what is envisioned in the bill is to develop a system where all of these opportunities could be available to students statewide, regardless of where they originate, and that there could be some type of uniform fee structure also. Ms. Fleming is probably the best person to answer that question.
When we get her up here, it seems more appropriate to ask Ms. Fleming those questions. Plus, I know at least one student in Salem is actually in China this year taking classes online.
Oh, cool.
Through SK Online.
Any questions, Senator Ringo?
Hi. Good morning, Senator Devlin. I'm sorry I missed the first part of your testimony. What's the price tag on this?
The price tag for basically setting up the online school, getting it running, and operating it during the first biennium will be approximately $2
million. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I think you answered everybody's questions. Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1071. No. I know we've got other folks. I've got an elected in the room. I want to get out of here. 3441. That's okay. Open a public hearing on House Bill 3441. Commissioner Adams, why don't you come forward? Ms. Harris, why don't you tell us what this bill does?
Thank you, Madam Chair, Committee. House Bill 3441A permits a municipal corporation with a population in excess of $200,000 that meets certain requirements to appoint public members to its budget committee. The majority of municipal corporations already include appointed members from the public on their committees. What this bill would do is allow certain municipal corporations that have been exempted from that law to take part and include the public in the budgeting process.
Okay. Thank you very much. Commissioner Adams, welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for hearing this bill today. Chair Brown, members of the Senate Rules Committee, I want to thank you for the opportunity to speak in favor of Senate Bill 3441 for reasons that have long been forgotten. In 1963, the state passed ORS 294.341, a bill that eliminated the participation of citizens, voting citizens, on the budget committee for municipalities that exceed a population of 200,000 individuals. So except for Portland, every other city in Oregon is required to have an equal number of appointed citizens on their budget committee as elected officials. So city councils with 5 members when they're acting as a budget committee, and in Oregon the budget committee is what comes up with the approved budget that then goes on to the elected body for adoption. So the budget process is there is a proposed budget from either the city manager or the mayor that the citizen budget committee considers and comes up with an approved budget, and then that goes on to the city council for adoption. every other city has to go through this process that includes citizen voting participation on the budget committee, except for Portland. And I would argue, and this bill has the support of the entire city council for the city of Portland, I would argue, given that Portland is a commission form of government where we have bureaus actually assigned to us, having outsiders who do not have bureaus assigned to them asking the kinds of outsider questions that are very, very healthy and helpful and help promote transparency is really important. So this simply gives the permission for the city of Portland to add voting citizens to our budget committee. It would not affect anybody else in terms of requiring them to do anything. The bill is only permissive in nature.
Commissioner Adams, do you know why the bill was passed in 1963?
Well, the best that we can ascertain is that the Tax Supervision and Conservation Committee process was set up for municipalities over a certain population. That's the best. That's around the same time that this provision requiring Portland to have voting citizens on its budget committee was implemented. My own personal view on that is that the Tax Supervision and Conservation Commission gets our budget after it's already approved. Its ability to make any changes or look deeply at the budgets, I would argue, is very limited because they're not sitting at the table where the decisions are being made. And that's why having citizens sit at the table where decisions are being made to ask the tough questions, I think, would be much more beneficial to taxpayers. I also want to just note that given that the Portland City Commission is five white guys, it also gives us an opportunity to add some diversity to the decision-making process. The city raises and spends $1.9 billion every year. And also the budget, just as with the state, also represents the work plan for city government as well. So giving ourselves the opportunity to have more diversity of perspective in how the budget is put together, I think, would be a benefit as well.
Thank you. Any questions for Commissioner Adams?
I was looking while you were talking at a letter from way back on April 4th. You were down here, and somebody from the Community College Association came up and talked about some unintended consequences for Mount Hood Community College. Did you guys take care of that in an amendment? Or
we did. We took care of that and had an opportunity to underscore with them that this is permissive, so they wouldn't be required unless they wanted to change the way they do budgets.
Okay. Thank you.
Sure.
Charlie Sarringo.
Good morning, Sam. Thanks for coming. It seems astonishing that we need this bill, but there it is.
Strangely enough, we can't add voting members to our budget committee without it.
Right. Okay. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Commissioner Adams. Close
thank
public
you very
hearing.
Much.
Open a work session on House Bill 3441. I assume there's no amendments. All right. Chair would move House Bill 3441 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? Hearing, seeing none. So ordered. All right. Let's go back up to 10. Senator Ringo.
I'm happy to carry that.
You have City of Portland? You do. Okay.
You.
We'll let you carry that one then. All right. Back up to Senate Bill 1071. Ms. Fleming, Mr. Green, and Ms. Wimmer Whalen. Why don't you guys come on up? Anybody else on 1071? Okay. Good morning.
Senator Brown, members of the committee, for the record, Deputy Superintendent Vicki Fleming, Oregon Department of Education. I'm here to speak in favor of Senate Bill 1071. As Senator Devlin mentioned, we have currently a situation where we have several school districts who are sponsoring online schools or charter environments, and this bill attempts to provide an umbrella infrastructure that would allow us to connect any publicly funded virtual learning opportunity to be available for any Oregon student. I think, quite simply, it's an idea whose time has come. We're a little behind the curve, in fact, and by creating a school district, we have this ability to connect SK Online with the Cool School in Lynn Benton Lincoln, ESD manages currently. So those connections horizontally in the K-12 system are very important for students to be able to, Senator Farioli's Frontier Learning Network, to be able to connect with SK Online in terms of content and opportunities. We have a proposal that is due to us at the end of this month for the design of a P16 alliance for e-learning. So in terms of horizontal connections, this bill would accommodate that. What we're also after in the long term is a vertical connection so that universities and community college offerings could be connected in a rational sort of portal in an organized fashion so a student could get on that portal. And if there is an opportunity to take an accelerated course from the community college and receive dual credit for high school and community college at the same time, this would be a way to accommodate that. In addition, there are universities around the state like Eastern Oregon University who has become very competent in a virtual environment, as has Oregon State University. So this is a connector, a way of building an infrastructure, and it's very conceptual at this point. I imagine you'll have questions about how it's going to work, and some of them we can answer and some of them we just can't because we're really in that building pioneering sort of phase. So I'll stop there.
You want us to ask questions? Dr.
Wait, please. Mr. Green.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Jim Green with the Oregon School Boards Association, also representing the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators today. Chuck Bennett had to be in another hearing. We appear today in support of this bill, and one of the things that we found real interesting when we started looking at this is that Oregon has no statutes, very little administrative rules on the issue of distance learning. The only one that's out there right now is in the Teacher Standards and Practices Commission as to who has to be a licensed educator in providing education into the state of Oregon. We see this bill as the ability to put some boundaries around what we do in distance education, as well as offer opportunities to kids across the state so that the students in Portland and the kids in Fields in rural Harney County have that same ability to receive that same valuable education. And we trust the Department of Education working with the partners to come up with a program that will address all the needs of students across the states and also put some boundaries on what's going to happen with regard to a virtual schools in our state. As I said, there's no rules. There's very little out there right now in the state, and we believe there ought to be some boundaries in place so we don't have folks coming into our state not offering a program that meets standards and not offering a program that doesn't provide a level of education for students who want to move on. And as I said, this will put the state on equal footing across. I think, Senator Ringo, you asked Senator Devlin how much this costs. It's anticipated the startup cost is $2 million, and we have agreed that that come off the top of the state school fund for this biennium. We believe it's important enough that this be taken on this biennium, allow that money to go to the Department of Ed and start that up. It's my understanding, working with the department, that from that point on, it could be self-sustaining through some of the charges and fees that they may assess, but they may also work through the next biennium with school districts on how to attain this. There's also nothing in this bill that does away with what current programs are. We have SK Online, as Ms. Fleming mentioned, Cool School down in Lynn-Benton Lincoln ESD, and the Frontier Learning Network out in the North Central ESD. Those will still be available, but we want to make sure that those are available statewide, and that's what this bill is about.
All right. Ms. Wimmer-Whalen.
Good morning. Madam Chair and committee members, Lori Wimmer-Whalen with the Oregon Education Association, and we do support the Senate Bill 1071. We do have a couple of minor issues that we've been assured will be resolved at the budget committee level, but what we like about this, as you've heard before, is the opportunity to bring some uniformity to a kind of an ad hoc system right now, and to rein in what we saw in the past are a couple ill-advised entrepreneurial efforts around the state that did, for example, offer a 1 to 150 ratio of instructors to students and some of those kinds of things in their proposals. Unfortunately, those didn't come to pass, but we believe with a uniform and organized system or framework for online education, there can be some quality control, which is a consumer protection issue for parents and for families, and also make sure that the virtual schools mirror the brick-and-mortar schools with respect to those elements that do protect the quality of education for students in public education in Oregon. So while removing barriers and providing some flexibility and choice, we believe that this bill is a step in the right direction toward the quality control aspects. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Questions, Senator Shields?
Yeah, kind of under that quality control and entrepreneurial piece, what about the fee structure? This young lady that I was referring to that I heard of in China has to pay a good bit of money to get her online classes. I don't know the details, but the family probably working in China. She's there with her family. She's not falling behind in school, but it's costing them a fair amount of money. Mm-hmm. What kind of fee structure are you looking at?
Chair Brown, Senator Shields, I think part of the investment in this is to figure that out. There are a variety of ways where the content is accessed globally, if you will. I think our intent in this bill was to make sure that any offering that is created and offered up in a public school environment is at no cost to a public school student. So the question is, how do you make sure that you're not unfairly disadvantaging or advantaging one district over another in the way that fee structure works? If, say, SK Online is providing content to students outside of Oregon, then they're paying tuition. And I'm not sure about the student that you're referring to, but our intent would be that if there's a course that a high school student in Medford needs and it's provided through the Frontier Learning Network, that under this district umbrella, you'd be able to access that course credit and it wouldn't cost you extra money.
This is a good thing. Yeah, the only other thing that I was thinking about was when you have students that may, for whatever reason, be expelled from a school or not allowed to go for a while, would they be able to access these so that they could keep up with coursework?
Chair Brown, Senator Shields, absolutely. We looked at many other states in terms of how they've developed their rules and their processes, and this would be available to an infirm student, perhaps someone with a health impairment or that didn't allow them to come to school. Teen parents, for example, during a period of time when they may be not mobile enough to get back and forth to a bricks and mortar classroom, that the content would be available to that as well.
And Madam Chair, Senator Shields, if I may, that's one of the nice things about this bill, because under the law, if we expel a student, we're required to offer them an alternative educational program. And in a number of our districts across the state, just because of their sheer size, they have very limited opportunity for that. This provides that opportunity so that if you have an expelled student, or as Ms. Fleming said, someone who, because of their medical reasons, can't attend school, mm-hmm. this provides that opportunity so that they can continue on with their educational program.
Just one final question. What you just said, you could even provide this if they had a computer lab at a juvenile detention facility or whatever, couldn't you?
And Madam Chair, Senator Shields, I think that's part of what's envisioned, because remember the Department of Ed has program responsibility for those educational programs with the Oregon Youth Authority, and they have state-of-the-art computer models in those programs. It would be an opportunity for those students as well.
All right. Any further questions?
Madam Chair.
Senator Farrioli.
I've got a couple of questions, Madam Chair. It seems to me that there's an awful lot of distance learning content online now. We see it from universities all over the United States being offered virtually everywhere. And explain, or at least help me understand why, again, it's necessary to have a central portal. Because there's, right now, the portal is the computer on my desk.
Chair Brown, Senator Farrioli, great question. I think the idea is that content is everywhere, that we have a system of standards in Oregon, and that somehow if we're paying for it in a public school environment, we need to know that at least the content is aligned to those standards, to the extent that if a student takes a credit, a course in a virtual environment, that it in fact is going to help them in the same way that it would in a bricks and mortar sort of environment. I think there's a lot of discussion with the Joint Boards of Education about more, better, faster, and acceleration. So in addition to making sure that you get content that's consistent and uniform, if you want to take a writing class or some kind of literature class in Oregon, we have some uniformity around that. But also to be able to access courses that move you along faster. I know there are lots of examples of advanced math courses that are simply not available in many of Oregon's rural districts because teaching core is not available to come to those communities. So this would be a way, really, of advancing that notion as well.
Senator Farrioli.
So would the Department of Education be responsible for accreditation of all this, all course content?
Chair Brown, Senator Farrioli, that's the idea of uniform and statewide standards would be to get all of those folks that are now providing online education to advise us in terms of what would be a reasonable set of requirements for both teacher licensure and teacher qualifications and the content of the coursework.
Senator Farrioli.
Madam Chair, let's just take a high school student who wants to take MIT math courses. you'd be responsible for accrediting the MIT instructor and the course content.
Chair Brown, Senator Farioli, no. I think this portal would allow access to that sort of an opportunity by virtue of linking, but we certainly couldn't oversee or provide administrative restrictions on anything outside of things that were created in the Oregon K-12 system.
But would that student get credit for that class that would be recognizable in Oregon?
Chair Brown, Senator Farioli, that would be a transaction that would possibly be accessed through this portal, but it would be a transaction financially that would happen between MIT and the student. I think we can regulate or provide a fee structure for anything outside of what a normal Oregon school district would be providing.
And Madam Chair, Senator Farioli, if I may on that point, this bill does not envision currently undoing a situation where MIT may enter into an agreement with, say, the Glide School District to provide an advanced math class. That's currently going on in the state right now. The idea is not to undo that. If the Glide School District says that MIT instructor online meets all the necessary requirements, that class has all the requirements in it, then that's going to be an agreement between that school district and MIT. The idea in this bill is just to provide that portal. We don't want to undo any agreements that are currently in place that provide that standard of education to those kids.
Any further questions?
Several. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Farioli.
One is logistic, and I'll get to that last. I just am really curious about the idea that it's really clear that we need some mechanism to try to control the course content and make sure that students are getting what they're getting the value of what's being offered and that they earn the credits that they are promised. But it also seems that there's a tremendous amount of content out there. And you're going to be playing chase the dragon, so to speak, with all the course content and offerings as they exponentially increase. And I just wonder if what we're doing is building a structure that's intended, I think, to be a very welcoming portal that doesn't turn into an administrative jungle. I mean,
Chair Brown, Senator Farioli.
Simple, transparent, easily accessible, understandable to students in the high schools.
Yes, absolutely. We wouldn't want to restrict access to content. In fact, we'd want to encourage it. And we think that by creating this infrastructure that will allow any public school student to come to one place and understand what's available in an organized, rational way, that in fact is provides an advantage to acceleration and a variety of other things that you were just talking about. We're never going to we have no intention of managing content because the content is rich and everywhere on the internet, but rather to provide access and opportunity to students who may not have it.
Sir, for you.
The bill restricts the number of students that can take online courses to 50% of the students that reside in the school district. Can you tell me why it's necessary to? I mean, if you get 50% plus one, does that knock them off the program? Is it, if you have 49% of kids that live within the school district, do they lose their accreditation?
Chair Brown, Senator Farioli, this that specific reference in the bill is to mitigate the circumstance that Mr. Green spoke of, which is that we have school districts who may, in fact, be starting virtual schools so that they can recruit on a statewide basis, particularly populations that may not necessarily be enrolled in school on a regular basis, and that by putting a box around that, we would mitigate for that possibility. We had a circumstance earlier in the year where the State Board of Education and the superintendent actually had to stop that from happening by virtue of the kind of instructional environment that Ms. Wimmer Whalen spoke to, which is that a ratio of one teacher to 150 kids was probably not an ideal environment. And in fact, the instruction was being provided by the parent rather than a licensed teacher.
And Madam Chair, Senator Farioli, that provision of the bill limits it only to a public charter school who offers classes online. And the 50%, you know, we're not married to that number. We'd look at any percentage in there. But we've had an instance in the state where a school district, a member of ours, actually went out and decided we're going to try to create one of these to grow our ADMW. Because, as you know, we're funded on an ADMW basis. They doubled their ADMW in a year by going after homeschoolers that were not only in this state but outside the state with no sort of standards on the curriculum. And what we tried to say in this instance is it's okay for you to create online classes as a charter school, but we want to at least try to say, and you know, we've talked about CAPS in here before, and remember CAPS were in the charter school law before that it sunsetted, but this is some sort of a protection in there so that you don't have school districts just running around out there going, let's create a virtual charter school and let's triple our ADMW so we can get more money into our school district and lower that level of lake that's in there for the state school fund. We're not married to the 50%, at least at the Oregon School Boards Association. We may even look at a sunset of that, perhaps, in amendments to this bill. But this is trying to put some sort of sideboards and boundaries around an issue that has been in litigation. And this bill's not only an attempt at trying to provide opportunities to school districts, it's also an opportunity to stop litigating these on a case-by-case basis, because that's what's going to happen if we don't have something in the law with regard to these type of standards.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Senator Farrelly.
Have you envisioned some sort of a conflict resolution process? Because I can see, you know, you're on uncharted ground, and this is a burgeoning area of potential educational outreach. It may touch a lot of students who have lost interest in traditional education. If it works, it will certainly be an outreach program. There's going to be an awful lot of folks who are coming to you with means, mechanisms, methods, and approaches that you've never seen before. If they don't fit the box, you know, what do you do with them? How do you welcome people to bring their ideas to this portal? And how do you resolve conflicts that may arise where you just have a difference of opinion with developers?
Chair Brown, Senator Farrelly, another great question. We have staff at the department and certainly the expertise that's represented next to me here that are in constant consultation with those folks that are in developing charter applications. And I think this online environment is a particularly bizarre one for a lot of people. They can't quite figure out how to make it work. And our intent would be to not squelch any good idea that actually provides more opportunity for kids, but in fact to encourage that. And I think we're in the process all the time of mediating and resolving conflicts about what those applications look like and whether or not they're going to meet the standard that we would all hope.
And Madam Chair, Senator Farrelly, to tag on to that, in the charter school world, if there's a denial of an application, remember we wrote into the law in 1999 that first goes to mediation so that there is a conflict resolution where we try to get the parties to yes. There's also a provision in ORS Chapter 338 that creates charter schools that any provision in the statute except this list of, like, you know, making sure child abusers aren't near kids and that they don't violate federal law and they don't violate our state standards, the State Department of Education, the State Board had the ability to waive any part of that statute in ORS Chapter 338 except that list of what we called really important things to ensure that kids are protected. So that there's always been that ability, and the State Board has granted those waivers when a charter applicant has asked or a school district has asked for those waivers in a charter school environment. But they do have a mediation process. They have a list of mediators that are used between school districts and charter school applicants. And to be honest with you, that's a process that has worked very well. In fact, I can only think of two instances where the mediation did not have the two groups coming to yes, where it ended up at the State Board at that point.
Madam Chair, just an observation on one final question. It's been argued, I think, pretty effectively that legislators wouldn't recognize a good idea if it fell on them in this process. Good has quotes around it. People bring, I mean, history is replete with good ideas that people just turned away and walked away from. You believe that the mediation process for setting up a charter school is efficacious in an issue where somebody just wants to bring course content and offer it?
And Madam Chair, Senator Farrelly, yes, I believe that's a process that has worked very well. Where a district has said, you know, no to this charter school idea, and what the mediator does, and I've been part of those mediations, they bring the two parties together and say, what would it take you, school district, to say yes to this? and the school district says, well, it would take this, and the charter applicants say, well, that's really not our vision, but we're willing to at least make some changes. And, you know, it's not a very short process. It can take a process to get through that. But the Department of Ed has on their contract very skilled mediators that bring the parties together. And even if they don't get agreement, at least at that point, they know what the key issues are left that goes up to the state board for review. And as I said, in most cases, it's worked out very well where they've mediated those disputes. The charter schools are created, and they're operated by the district, which is what you want. You want local school districts working with the local applicant.
Madam Chair, I would I'd like to put the chair on notice that I have to work with the chief sponsor to see if I couldn't come to agreement with him about some language on virtual charter schools mediation, to put in the body of the bill to make specific reference to it, so people understand with the package that if they have a difficulty in getting their idea across the threshold, that there's a mechanism for them to access. And then just the final observation or question, Madam Chair, if you don't mind. The virtual portal, does that need to be a bricks and mortar process, or can you actually locate the whole system virtually? And what I mean by that is, could you put instructors that would review course content throughout the state of Oregon? Could there not be a physical plant located in Salem to hang this framework off of, but could it in fact be virtually located, so that we're making this a demonstration of virtual education as well as an attempted outreach at virtual education?
Chair Brown, Senator Ferrioli, yes, to all of those things. There are many reasons to do this, and I think part of it is the encouraging aspect of change management at the user end of this, which would be teachers. We're working not only on this concept at the department, but with an online professional development strategy that would allow teachers to create learning communities no matter where they lived through computers or internet or whatever. I think that's the direction that we need to go. To our knowledge, there is not another state in the nation who has created a virtual school district umbrella. Most states have chosen to fund at a much greater extent than $2 million virtual schools, but this would create that ability to kind of manage through all those, how much per student should we be paying in a virtual environment versus a bricks and mortar environment? Does it cost the same amount of money? All of those are questions that I think are still unanswered that will come with our development of this district.
Senator Ferrioli, in response to your question about working with a sponsor, my understanding is the sponsor has been working on this bill throughout the entire session. It will be going to Senate Budget Committee. I would ask that you work with him there on any technical amendments. I'm really concerned about holding it up at this point.
Good, Madam Chair.
Right.
My concern is that this becomes a portal and not a restrictor valve.
All right. Thank you. All right. Senator Ringo.
Thank you. I just wanted to follow up on something Mr. Green said about charter schools who they were receiving ADMW by offering online courses to out-of-state children.
No.
Is that what you said?
Madam Chair, Senator Ringo, that was what was envisioned. They were going to offer it, and it was down in the Coquille School District. They were going to offer not only curriculum and education offerings to homeschool students in the state, they were also looking potentially going over the borders of the state of Oregon to provide educational services to boys and girls. Now, obviously, they couldn't claim those as ADMW and receive state school fund dollars, but they were going to grow their ADMW from the in-state students.
I see. So you can assure me that nobody's offering online courses to out-of-state students and getting accredited ADMWs.
Madam Chair, Senator Ringo, yes. Okay. They are not getting ADMW for students that are not in the state.
Thank you. Since we can't afford to fund our students as it is, we'd be hard-pressed to be funding Idaho ADMW. Senator Ringo.
Thank you. I just want to understand this a little bit better than I do. So there'd be the Oregon Virtual School District that would provide the online courses. Now the Virtual School District can obtain those courses from a variety of sources, such as
public charter schools, school districts, ESDs, community colleges, state institutions, or any other public or private entity. So just to help me understand this, so that, let's say, the Portland School District has developed its own online math course, then the Oregon Virtual School District could purchase that from Portland School District and then offer it statewide?
Chair Brown, Senator Ringo, yes, absolutely. There'd be a fee structure that would prescribe what a math course is worth in Portland or anywhere else around the state, and then that would provide us with some uniformity about access to that.
What? I'm trying to understand when a school district, or an ESD for that matter, or a public charter school for that matter, should be using its resources to develop that kind of curriculum as opposed to focusing on educating the children within its district.
Chair Brown, Senator Ringo, that's currently happening. I think by virtue of the ability of ESDs in particular to be entrepreneurial, some of them have created these online schools and environments so that they can in fact provide content and charge districts, then that comes out of the district ADM, and the transaction happens there.
And Madam Chair, Senator Ringo, it's not only an entrepreneurial aspect of it, it's also an aspect of we're in a different world now. And we have students that need different learning environments for a variety of purposes. One that Senator Shields already mentioned was a student who's been expelled, and there's very few alternative options for them at that point. Say Salem-Keizer Online was created to deal with online schools that they didn't have alternative placements for, to deal with pregnant parenting teens. A mother who has a baby at home and they wanted to be able to provide educational services. Barbara Roberts High School in town has been created, but they needed other places for those types of educational environments to go on. And to be honest with you, SK Online, Cool School, and the Frontier Learning Network, which is up in the North Central ESD, they weren't created to be entrepreneurial. They were created to provide opportunities for kids in those school districts and in those areas so that they could have the educational programs that are available across the state where they weren't available at that time to those students.
Madam Chair.
Senator Ringo.
You know, Vicki, we've had a lot of conversations about ESDs, and this is what drives me crazy, the idea that they might be entrepreneurial in this regard, so that some ESD administrator somewhere says, gee, I think we might be able to make money for the ESD by creating a course, by contracting with a newly established virtual school district. I would rather ESDs focus on providing services to kids within the boundaries of that ESD. And it bothers me to think ESDs, much less school districts, will engage in entrepreneurial efforts to develop online courses. I want them to be teaching kids.
Chair Brown, Senator Ringo, I would back up a little bit and say that I think the online providers that currently exist probably have created those online schools at the request of largely the rural districts in their state so that they can have access to things, as Mr. Green said, that they wouldn't have access otherwise. So this, I think the school district notion is about taking the best of what currently exists. And as you know, those local districts in those areas, particularly, I'm sure Senator Farioli could speak to how the Frontier Learning Network came to be. Most of our school districts in Oregon are very small and very rural and have very hard time accessing the kind of continuum of offerings that in your district would be represented in a high school curriculum. So I think a lot of those have emerged because school districts have said, we need that, and we need access to community college coursework, et cetera. The Oregon Public Education Network started with a connection of video conferencing opportunity, which didn't actually end up providing the kind of full-blown statewide increase in access to content that we would have hoped. And this is a way, I think, of carrying it forward even further.
Well, Madam Chair, I appreciate that. I think school districts and ESDs should respond to the needs of the kids in that district. It bothers me, and you use the word entrepreneurial. I don't think it's their mission to go out and do money-making activities.
All right. Any more questions about the bill?
That is about the bill, because we're giving authorities for them to contract with ESDs.
All right. Thank you very much. Senator Starr, are you here on this particular bill as well?
Yes, I am.
Okay.
Madam Chair, I'm Senator Charles Starr representing Senate District 13.
I also brought a bill this session regarding virtual school. We've had a little bit of discussion on the idea and looked at a little bit at what other states have done regarding virtual charter schools. Education in the future is going to be totally different than we recognize it today. It's not going to be the bricks and mortar schoolhouse that we see, that we're spending multiplied millions of dollars building. I hope we can find a good use for those buildings, because today education is available. As I've handed out to you, developed right here in Oregon, is a complete K-12 program, complete curriculum, superior to what the state mandates for our students. It's available to any parent, any student who can come up with $295. They educated virtually on their own through CD-ROMs that they can insert in their computer. We put this control in the State Department of Education. We're going to continue to promulgate the standards that are required of the state, which is at present 22 credits for graduation. We don't have the caliber of math and science and English language required of our students that is necessary in this day and age. I think that as this bill goes forward, we make a mistake in putting this in the State Department of Education. We are on the verge of a revolution in education in America, and if we define it down to the standards established by the state, we're going to continue to have a quality of education that's not adequate for this century. I'm hopeful that we will exercise care, as you are aware, sending this down to Ways and Means. Probably makes it difficult for it to go forward. In any event, I proposed in Senate Bill 684 a different model for virtual schools in Oregon, a chance for school districts to authorize virtual schools, as some have tried on their own, offering an education online for students in the most remote portions of Oregon, and doing that under the ADM, offering that to the very students that were testified about, those who have dropped out, those who are parenting teen moms, those who need to complete an education, would have that opportunity. We found that virtual schools in Ohio, the ECOT, the Electronic Classroom of Tomorrow in Ohio, thought that they would be signing up homeschoolers, but in fact they signed up the students on both ends of the bell curve from every district in the state of Ohio, students who are currently underserved in our education system today, those students who are not learning at the bottom of the bell curve, those who are extremely sharp, smart at the top end of the bell curve, not getting the kinds of instruction opportunities that they need, that is available to them through the virtual school program. And that is where we need to accentuate the opportunity for every student in the state of Oregon. And we all know that we're underfunding the education model under which we are operating today. But with virtual education, we can adequately support a quality of education for every student without regard to where they live. Speaking here in opposition to the Senate bill that's before you, I think it's the wrong direction for us to take for virtual schooling in Oregon, and I would hope that you would consider my testimony, the handout that I gave you, advertises a virtual education for $295 that would be superior to anything offered in the state of Oregon today. And we would do well to consider such an avenue for the education of the students in our state. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Starr, so you're not opposed to online education. You're opposed to the Department of Education having any kind of control and creating some sort of uniformity in terms of what's taught online?
I think that is managed by, Madam Chair, that is managed by the fact that charter authorization depends on what is offered, and if it's not adequate, then they can deny the charter. And to set it at the state level, I think, is denying the local control kind of system that we desire and have had up until the present time.
Okay. Other questions? Senator Shields.
Real quick. Senator Starr, I looked carefully at your handout, and I'm impressed at a complete 12-year curriculum, you know, the $195 and so on, but one of the arrows below refers to a 1911 Encyclopedia Britannica and a 1913 Noah Webster's Dictionary. Are those the years that they're using?
That is the years they're using.
Why is that?
I don't know. I have not researched that portion, but I think that if you would go back to that Noah Webster's Dictionary, you would find that it supports a lot more than just definition of words, but the character of individuals in our society as recognized as beneficial.
Thank you.
Senator, one more question. No Child Left Behind. I mean, we're really moving in the opposite direction of local control with the federal mandates. How do you see, I mean, with No Child Left Behind, we're basically at the whim of the federal government in terms of what we're teaching and our schools passing standards, et cetera. How do you see virtual education fitting in with No Child Left Behind?
Very well. The No Child Left Behind has provision for the homeschooled student, which is evidenced by the fact that there's no regulation of homeschooling in the bill. The very fact that homeschoolers are scoring from 30 to 35% higher on every subject matter than those educated in the public system demands that we recognize the benefits of a home education. So I see no conflict at all with No Child Left Behind.
Okay, thank you. Anything else? Thank you very much, Senator Starr. We appreciate you being here this morning.
Thank you.
Anybody else wishing to testify on Senate Bill 1071? Close the public hearing. Open a work session on Senate Bill 1071. We need to refer this down to
The Senate Budget Committee, the chair would move Senate Bill 1071 to the Senate Budget Committee with a due pass recommendation. Any further discussion? Would you please call the roll?
Senator
Atkinson? No.
Senator Rico?
Aye.
Senator Shields?
Aye.
Vice Chair Farioli?
No.
Chair Brown?
Chair votes aye. Motion passes. Thanks. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 785 and Senate Bill 786. Mr. Simmons, why don't you come forward?
Madam Chairman, you have not closed the public hearing on 1071, and I'd like to make a vote explanation.
Sure.
Madam Chairman, I think there's a lot of merit to the bill. I just believe that there are a couple of things that are not answered, and I've become skeptical of the operation of the Budget Committee. So I would rather have the opportunity to make those issues known to this committee and with the permission of the principal sponsor to add just the language that adds the conflict resolution that is already part of other statutes dealing with charter schools. And I know that we've already taken action on the bill, but I just wanted to make for the record very clear that I don't think there's necessarily anything wrong with the bill. I think it could be made a lot better with just a little extra work.
Great. Thank you. I'm sure Senator Evelyn will look forward to you working with him on that bill. With that, we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 1071, open public hearing from Senate Bill 785 and 786. Mr. Simmons, Ms. Harris, why don't you tell us a little bit about both of these bills, please?
Thanks, Madam Chair. Both of these bills deal with the nursery, plant nursery industry in Oregon. Senate Bill 785 creates a plant pest and disease emergency response fund, and Senate Bill 786 creates forest seeding growers cooperatives and provides for the management and funding of those cooperatives.
All right, Mr. Simmons.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Chair Brown, members of the committee, thank you for hearing both these bills this morning. The nursery industry in Oregon is a real success story, a unique Oregon success story. And Senate Bill 785 creates a plant pest and disease emergency response fund that enables the Department of Agriculture to respond quickly to new plant pests and disease threats as they arrive in the state of Oregon that could threaten the integrity of Oregon's nursery industry or the position of Oregon's nursery industry in the marketplace. It puts together a $250,000 emergency response fund that is funded through an assessment on nursery license fees, so there's no impact to the state general fund budget. The Department of Ag, Mr. Dan Hilburn, who runs the plant division of the Department of Agriculture, is here with me. We have coordinated very closely with them on this legislation.
Any comments you wish to make?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Dan Hilburn. I'm with the Oregon Department of Agriculture. We fully support this bill, and just a couple of reasons. One, globalization of trade in plants has taken off, and is the risks of introducing diseases and insects are much higher than they were just a little while back. Secondly, the window of opportunity for dealing with these diseases is very small, so that we often have days or weeks to jump on a new problem, and having an emergency fund available ready to go would really allow us to do that. And the final thing I'd like to say is that this is the nursery industry stepping forward, asking you to allow them to assess themselves. We have an industry committee, a nursery regulatory and advisory committee, who would regulate this fund, so it wouldn't just be the department deciding whether or not we have an emergency to use it. The industry would be advising us on that. We're fully supportive of the bill and hope that you'll pass it out of this committee.
Thank you. Any questions? Thank you very much. Appreciate you being here. Mr. Dan Hilborn?
Senate Bill 786.
Okay.
Chair. Mr. Mike Bordelon and Mr.
Okay.
Ted Lawrence.
All right.
From the
All right. Okay. Is there a Dan Hilborn in the... You are. Okay. All right. But I also have... the reason why I'm confused is I have a Denise Sutton signed up. And she signed up, I think, for 1071, but she signed up for on Senate Bill 785. So, okay. All right. Thanks. Go ahead, guys.
Madam Chair, we have before you Senate Bill 786, again Mark Simmons from the Oregon Association of Nurseries. This is a response to a request of the Emergency Board a little over a year ago directing the Department of Forestry to work with stakeholders to consider alternatives to procuring forest seedlings for family forest lands. What this bill does, it provides a permissive, it is permissive and non-prescriptive. It narrowly broadens the options.
Can I ask, are you discussing the Dash 1 amendments now?
Yes.
Okay,
yes.
Not the bill itself.
Correct.
Okay, thank you.
Senator Ringo, the bill was came out on the deadline and was not drafted, did not accurately reflect the intent of the department or the members of the stakeholder group that put this together. And so the Dash 1 amendment does replace the entire bill and more accurately reflects what we would like to see happen with your blessing. But it is a it's a permissive and non-prescriptive narrow broadening of the options at the Oregon Department of Forestry's disposal to secure forest seedlings. That could include leasing the state nursery, the D.L. Phipps Nursery down in Elkton. It could include the co-op arrangement that your administrator Tiffany Harris mentioned in her introductory remarks. And it also provides a slight broadening then to support those activities of the use of the nursery revolving fund. So.
All right. Thank you.
Ted Lawrence, an assistant state forester with the Oregon Department of Forestry. I think Mark described the bill very well, the Dash 1 amendments. We do support them. We think it provides permissive authority to allow the board to explore some important options to provide seedlings to family forest landowners in a more effective and efficient manner. And we look forward to working with Mark and the nurserymen and other stakeholders in exploring those options. Mike Bordelon here. Some of the details that led us up to this process, we'd like to cover that. Otherwise, I'm here to say we'd like to have your support to that.
Okay. Oh, I got it. Okay. All right. Okay. All right. Got it. Do you want to add anything?
If I need to, Chair Brown, members of the committee, just a very quick history here. 2003 legislative budget note directed us to work with private nurseries to explore some alternatives around the issue of competition with the state forest nursery.
Yeah.
As Mark mentioned, formed a task force, and that task force came to agreement, went to the Board of Forestry. The Board of Forestry recommended that their authority be broadened in a permissive way so that we can produce reliable and a stable supply of tree seedlings for reforestation, and this bill allows the board that broadening of authority. We're department of support of the Dash 1.
Okay. Mr. Swimmons, this is sort of a question for you in terms of the Dash 1 amendments, lines 19 through 23 create an exemption from unlawful trade practices in Oregon, but also federal antitrust laws. Did you have a specific conversation with legislative counsel about that particular issue, and could you please enlighten the committee, you or other
Thank
folks?
Thank you, Madam Chair. One of the options the task force came to was an arrangement whereby a cooperative of private forest seedling growers could form. The state would forecast demand for seedlings, aggregate that demand, and then allocate it across the co-op. And it was the council of our good folks in legislative council that we should have some kind of specific mention in the bill of that and protection of that from antitrust laws if that was to proceed. Now, this bill does not bind the department to follow that kind of model. It provides, but it does allow them to follow that kind of model if there's an agreement among all the stakeholders. And one of the issues of concern in our discussions has been the jobs in Elkton, and so there's been discussion of leasing the nursery, perhaps leasing the nursery to a cooperative of growers, but having the legal protections to do so was important.
Okay, Senator Farioli.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I understand the thrust and the need The federal antitrust laws are very strict, and they've been applied rigorously against collusion in purchasing timber from the federal forests or providing contract services to federal forestry. And by its very nature, the aggregated demand distributed over a cooperative membership would be collusive. I think that line 23, the last four words, amount to a prayer.
Well, time would tell if this is followed through on Chair Brown, Senator Perioli. We would certainly find out.
So right. Is it the director of the Department of Forestry that does?
No, we're gonna have Ms. Harris.
Or is it the director of the DL Fitzner?
We're gonna have Ms. Harris call, but this is not that dissimilar from the bill we passed last week, exempting, asking the FBI to destroy fingerprints. So, Ms. Harris is calling LC to see if there's some specific exemption. Otherwise, I think those last four words are in big trouble in terms of this committee. So,
directing the FBI to destroy the fingerprints.
So, anyway,
you can always ask.
Exactly. So, okay. Any other questions, Senator Shields?
Question you might contemplate at times, but nobody probably articulates. You're setting up mechanisms to respond to an emergency potentially because of globalization. You bring in something from someplace else, and that's the first bill you were talking about. But since we have a hearing open on both, I wanted to return to that question. It seems to me that we bring maybe exotic bushes or plants or whatever from someplace else, and then if there's an infestation of some sort, we're ready to respond real quick. Are we doing anything proactively? It seems like with globalization and moving stuff all over the planet, we may be homogenizing the whole place in terms of insects and diseases and so on. Are we doing things proactively before we ship this stuff in from wherever?
Senator Shields, Madam Chair, Senator Shields, thank you for that question. And yes, we are. There are strict rules and guidelines for importation of plant products. And within Oregon, there are reporting requirements. If you import anything from another state, you're required to let the Department of Forestry know what it was. And if they think there's any potential issue, you have to hold it, and they can come out and inspect it. Mr. Hilburn is a greater expert on all the mechanisms that are in place to protect Oregon and the nation from foreign plant pests and disease threats than I am. But yes, there are.
All right. Senator Ringo.
Thank you. The original bill would have phased out the D.L. Phipps nursery. And the amendment doesn't do that. What's the long-range goal here, to keep that nursery running but also to have more supply from private growers? Is that kind of where we're headed?
Chair Brown, Senator Ringo, the thought here is that the D.L. Phipps nursery, even if this private cooperative forms, is a necessary contingency to keep in place for some length of time to ensure that there's a seedling supply for landowners in Oregon. So while we're trying to form up a private nursery cooperative, there's no guarantee that over time that is going to be successful. We're hopeful. So the Phipps nursery, maintaining that Phipps nursery is an important contingency, at least for a while here, while we try to form this nursery cooperative.
Sure. Ringo.
Does Department of Forestry believe that it can acquire the seedlings cheaper from the D.L. Phipps nursery, or could acquire them cheaper from a private co-op?
Senator Ringer, Chair Brown, members of the committee. Basically, running a nursery for the business that we're in, which is providing speculative seedlings for family forest landowners, is a high-risk business that requires a somewhat higher costs that we then pass back to the consumer. There are a number of business reasons why we think that a cooperative where the risk can be shared with private growers might be much more effective and efficient than running a nursery on our own. So our interest is not in running a nursery. It's in providing good seedling stock that covers the range of private forest lands interests around the state and address the speculative nature of that business. And so we're hopeful this private partner collaboration can be an effective and more efficient process, recognizing that if it doesn't work, we do have a contingency to fall back on. But ultimately, the fate of the nursery is something that will depend upon the outcome. But that, again, we are not in the business of having a nursery. It's in the business of providing seedlings. If we can get out of that business of running nursery and still provide the seedlings, we'd like to do that.
Thank you.
Thank you. Anybody else? Thank you all very much. Why don't you hang around? We've got Mr. Taylor here from Legislative Council.
Questions on the reference to federal, they can articulate their question.
Thank you. Mr. Taylor, can you enlighten us? I'm not so concerned about lines 20 through 22, but we're all sort of concerned about the last four words, or federal antitrust laws. I mean, I'm assuming we don't have any ability to sort of exempt ourselves. Otherwise, we probably would have done it under No Child Left Behind. But, can you enlighten us at all on these couple of words?
Chair Brown, members, good morning. I'm Chuck Taylor from Legislative Council. Wish I had known the issue before coming down here.
That's okay. Sorry. You want to take a minute and look at it? Because we can close the public hearing and come back and work on some other stuff.
I would rather be able to take a moment and give you a more intelligent answer, if I may.
Thanks. That's fine. We're going to close the public hearings on Senate Bill 785 and 786. Let's move down. House Bill 3329, the amendments, they're still trying to reach a consensus on the amendments that were drafted. The chair would move into work session on redrafting and introduction of bills. The chair would move the redrafting and introduction of LC 3666. The bill creates a public commission on the Oregon legislature.
3666.
Correct. The Senate President has requested a redraft of this bill introduction. I can guarantee you that your vote in support of drafting and introduction will not delay the end of session, nor does your support indicate your support or opposition to the substance of the measure. Any discussion?
I think those are horribly lousy numbers to be signed to a commission on.
Well, it's just the LC number, Senator Atkinson.
All right.
Any further discussion? Any objection? Thank you very much. Okay, let's move from the bottom up. Senate Bill 1067. Ms. Harris, can you refresh our memories? I think we just lost a quorum on this bill.
How did we just lose a quorum?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senate Bill 1067 expands the statutory crime of telephonic harassment to include things like voicemail messages and text messaging. And we had a public hearing on this bill last week, and for whatever reason, we didn't actually move into a work session.
I think we were lacking a quorum. As members might recall, Mike Dugan, who's came on behalf of the Oregon District Attorneys Association, Mr. Dugan is the district attorney at Deschutes County. There are no amendments, correct?
Correct.
The chair would move Senate Bill 1067 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? Hearing seeing none, so order. I'd like Senator Johnson to carry that particular bill, please. House Bill 3206. Yes. Okay. This Phil, you might recall, folks, we heard last week it prohibits essentially the state of Washington ESDs from coming down and bidding on our local public improvement contract. I think the folks, Ms. Adamson, do you want to come on up? Thank you for joining us today. My understanding is there's no amendments, but that the parties did attempt to try and work something out. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, that is correct.
And you were unsuccessful?
We were unsuccessful.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Any questions for Ms. Adamson? All right. The Chair would move House Bill 3206 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Any further discussion? Would you please call the roll?
Yes.
Senator Rico?
Aye.
Senator Shields?
Aye.
Vice Chair Farrelly?
Aye.
Chair Graham?
Chair votes aye. Who would like to carry this?
Madam Chair.
Senator Ringo, thank you for volunteering.
Because it takes away the authority of a certain ESD, even though it's not in our state.
Madam Chair.
Senator Farrelly.
Before you close the public hearing, I hope we track this.
As a work
measure.
Session.
Right. I mean,
yes.
I hope we track this measure throughout the interim, because it would be incomprehensible to me to think that there won't be reciprocation and fallout from this.
Except that, Senator Farrelly, our ESDs don't have the ability to, I think, be entrepreneurial in the way that Washington State ESDs do. So I'm not sure it's going to be so easy to reciprocate.
No, I'm not so sure about that, Madam Chair.
They can be extremely creative.
Okay. You're saying there will be consequences. All right. On that happy note, let's move into work session on House Bill 2077. Ms. Harris, why don't you tell us what we've got in front of us? And anybody wishing to testify on the amendments? Everybody okay with the amendments? I see Susan Snyder from the City of Portland, Will Tiffany from Association of Oregon Counties, you guys are all alike, and Ms. Adamson all from AGC, all getting their approval. Ms. Harris, why don't you just tell us about the amendments?
Thank you, Madam Chair. We heard this bill last week also, and again, this was the bill that directs the Department of Transportation to adjust amounts paid to contractors to deal with sudden and unanticipated spikes in the price of steel. And one of the sticking points at the public hearing last week was the effect that the bill might have on municipalities. And what the focus of the amendment is to reconcile the differing interests, or I should say unite the interests, of proponents of the original measure and municipalities.
All right. Senator Ringo.
You know, my stack of bill files, this bill did not make it into the stack. But thank you, Senator Atkinson. I'm trying to understand, do these amendments therefore, do they make this so all we're doing is setting up the rules? Or does it actually go back and bail out those contractors?
I'm sorry, Senator Ringo. What was your question?
I don't remember either.
Okay. My understanding from my review of the amendments is that the bill would exempt out the local cities' projects that are funded, federally funded projects under the statewide transportation improvement plan. Number two, Section 4 Section 4 provides a clarification that you and I were concerned about. It repealed the provisions of the bill on January 2 of 2010. And
so, Madam Chair, I guess the concern I had at the time was that if ODOT has some money and they think this is appropriate, that's one thing, but I was concerned about the municipalities or local governments, and I just want to make sure.
That's why we drafted the amendment, Senator Rango.
Being absolutely clear on that.
Ms. Adamson.
So how much is this going to cost ODOT then?
Chair Brown, Senator Ringo, we're not sure at the time. I know that ODOT probably has a better sense of what it could cost them, but it does exempt local city projects, and
To federally funded projects.
Correct. And it also clarifies that ODOT needs to set up an escalation-de-escalation clause, and same with the fuel, so that there is a shared risk and it puts an end date on when these claims can be filed. So it, we believe it takes care of many of the concerns that were raised at the last hearing.
Madam Chair, I guess I'd still like some estimate as to what this will cost ODOT.
Mr. Jackley, do you want to come forward? Ms. Plank, you want to be? Okay. Mr. Jackley.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, our estimate of the impact of the bill is approximately $5 million. Could be a little more, could be a little less. We'll know once we get a better idea when we go through the rulemaking and actually open up the contracts and see what kind of claims we get.
And Mr. Jackley, as my memory serves me, that was the same figure you gave us last week, as I recall.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, that's correct.
Okay.
And is that $5 million this biennium, or is it?
Madam Chair, Senator Ringo, this would be our total estimate of what we might have to pay out between April 1st, 2003 and the close date that's in the amendment of October 1st, 2005.
Much love, Frank.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Sarah Atkinson, did you have a question? Okay. Thank you very much. Chair would move the Dash A4 amendments to House Bill 2077. Any objection? I'm sorry, any discussion? Any objection? Hearing seeing none, so ordered. Chair would move House Bill 2077 as amended to the Senate floor of the due pass recommendation. Any further discussion?
Madam Chair?
I think you should do it, Senator Farioli. Mm-hmm. Senator Ringo?
I am just uneasy with the retroactive bailout, and I understand the testimony in favor of it. It's $5 million of ODOT money, and I think that's a lot of money, and so I have concerns in that regard.
Okay, thank you. All right, Sarah Farioli.
Oh, Madam Chairman, this was testified to that it would prevent sudden and unanticipated spikes in the price of steel, when in fact it will prevent sudden and unanticipated steals in the price of spikes. So I think Senator Shields has to carry this bill.
I was getting ready to say the whole bill is a steal.
All right. Would you please, any further discussion? Will you please call the roll?
Senator Atkinson?
Yes.
Senator
Vito?
No.
Senator Shields?
Aye.
Chair votes aye. Motion passes. Who would like to? Do you want to carry this one,
Thanks,
Senator Shields? Okay.
I've been nominated.
All right. Senator Shields will carry. All right. Where are we on 785 and 786? Did we lose Mr. Taylor? Oh, no. Why don't we be in recess for 5 minutes and see if we can't work something out? Before folks leave, there is a reminder. We are having a hearing at 4 o'clock today. It is on a resolution. It is a gut and stuff. The issue is a memorial to Congress on the BRAC process, the base realignment and closure process. I don't know if the Speaker and the Senate President are coming or what important people in the legislature, but we'd appreciate your attendance. So we'll be in recess for about 5 minutes.
I'll be watching the
All right. Mr. Taylor, that little provision.
Yes, and I'm sorry I didn't have the answer for you. So.
Totally okay.
I knew I researched it at the time I drafted it. I just wanted to recheck things. And basically, the situation is that where the state can engage in supply or require the purchase of things through the state, there's no reason they cannot delegate that out to a private organization, a agricultural cooperative,
okay. All right.
Especially, provided
that they maintain sufficient state regulation and oversight to ensure that things don't get out of hand, that the evils of price fixing don't come into things. And that is why we provided the oversight in the bill.
Okay. Does that answer everybody's questions? Thank you. Sarah Ferrioli.
Is it still appropriate that we are trying to, with statute, confer or convey immunity from prosecution? Or should we not just recite that the intention is that there not be a violation of the Antitrust Act? Charge the agency with avoiding violations.
What we are basically doing there is claiming the state's exemption and claiming that that applies, that we are acting under the state's exemption.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right.
That clarifies my question.
All right. Thank you very much. We're in work session on Senate Bill 786. The chair would move, Senate 85. The chair would move Senate Bill 785 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Any further discussion? Yes. Any objection? Hearing and seeing none, so ordered. Senator Atkinson, aren't you a chief sponsor on this bill?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, since you've been a good boy today, we're going to let you carry it. Close the work session on Senate Bill 785.
Good boy.
Open a work session on Senate Bill 786. The chair would move the -1 amendments to Senate Bill 786. Any discussion? Any objection? Hearing and seeing none, so ordered. Chair would move Senate Bill 786 as amended to the Senate floor with due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? Hearing and seeing none, so ordered. Senator Atkinson, you get to carry both.
Smashing.
Thank you very much. We'll see you all back at 4 o'clock.